I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Time may be running out for American Paul Johnson, kidnapped in Saudi Arabia Saturday. His captors, a group called Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, say they'll execute Johnson unless the Saudi government releases imprisoned militants. The deadline is sometime today. In Saudi Arabia, American and local security forces are continuing their search for Johnson, and a Saudi friend has said in a letter to a militant website that Johnson's life should be spared. Khalid Maina is an editor with the Arab News. He joins us from Jeddah in Saudi Arabia. Khalid, what are you hearing Saudis saying?
I was in Riyadh just 2 hours ago. In today's Friday prayers, people were praying for Mr. Johnson's safety. There are lots of people who phoned us at the Arab News in the paper. People are talking about it. People are really upset that these evil people and will not do anything that will harm Mr. Johnson.
I understand that the Saudi man who says that he is a friend of Mr. Johnson's has extended what is, we understand, is known as an IJARA, I-J-A-R-A, saying that he would extend his protection to Mr. Johnson.
There has been. In fact, yesterday there was a letter to all foreigners in the kingdom by a well-known businessman in Jeddah who said that the Saudis will support with their lives, if necessary, the people who live amongst them, because, in fact, we're all upset about it. This is a country where usually there are no armed robberies, no kidnappings, no rapes, and suddenly to have political violence in our midst is really upsetting all of us.
The letter writer says, "I will curse you in all my prayers if Mr. Johnson is harmed." But we know that there are other websites where the debate is raging as to why he should be killed. Can you tell us some of the things that you're reading in the newspapers or hearing on websites that people are saying as to why Mr. Johnson should be killed?
I think one of the reasons these people want Mr. Johnson killed is that they have seen the pictures of the Abu Ghraib prisons and the torture and the prison abuses, and I think they want to justify their murder by saying that this is a tit-for-tat situation.
Well, how's the search going? How many searchers are there?
In fact, my people saw yesterday helicopters hovering about in some of the districts. There have been house-to-house searches. There are roadblocks where the car trunks have been opened. People's IDs have been looked at. I think the police, they are scouting areas that are known to have maybe Al-Qaeda sympathizers or where they suspect Mr. Johnson may have been taken.
We understand that clerics have also issued rulings, one saying that anyone who came to Saudi Arabia with a valid visa should be protected. And then, as I said, in the letters to the editor and in other places, others are saying, no, they should be killed. What does this say about the militants? Because it's the understanding of many Americans that these are religious fanatics, and yet they don't seem to abide by the ruling of the cleric.
They are not religious at all. I mean, there's nothing that is religious about them. These are pure, evil, murderous people who have brought shame upon this country. And trying to damage the image of our culture and ideology.
And are the Saudi Arabians seeing the pictures that we're seeing here in America of Mr. Johnson's family?
Yes, we are. The response, seeing his family and his sister and her picture, is a human response because we feel, we have empathy. We realize that this is a situation, anything can happen. We imagine this could be one of our own or a Saudi or an Asian or whoever it is. We really are upset and we are sorry.
Mr. Al-Maina, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Khalid Al-Maina is an editor with Arab News. He joined us from Saudi Arabia. Well, last night, about 100 of Paul Johnson's family and friends gathered in his hometown of Eagleswood Township, New Jersey, for a candlelight vigil. Johnson's daughter and niece led the gathering in the Lord's Prayer.
Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil.
WHYY reporter Aries Keck was at that vigil. Aries, can you tell us what that felt like?
It was a pretty moving ceremony. It's a very small town, and just about everyone there has either met Paul Johnson Jr. or a member of his family. It's also clearly a very religious town. The mood last night sometimes had the feel of a religious tent revival, as pastor after pastor called on for direct intervention from God to save Paul Johnson.
It's interesting because we just heard that Islamic clerics are calling on the same thing in Saudi Arabia. What about his family? How are they doing?
They seem to be holding up fairly well. They're pretty much in seclusion. They haven't been talking to the media very much, aside from a very public plea that Paul Johnson Jr.'s son gave while he held his grandson in his lap that was out earlier, pleading for his father's life. Now, some members of the family were at the vigil last night, and some other ones have made a few statements, but so far most of them just seem to be waiting.
Have people from New Jersey said to you that they are aware of this letter campaign that's going on online in Saudi Arabia, a Saudi who says he's a friend of Paul Johnson's writing a letter to directly to the kidnappers? Have they heard about this at all?
Not that I know of, but a similar thing is going on in New Jersey. They have what they call prayer circles going around, where they have congregations meeting all last night through the night and then also this morning, getting together to make public pleas and getting together also to, as I said before, make a direct plea to God.
Does his family and do his friends that they've told you, do they understand why both the Saudi government and the U.S. government have said they will not negotiate with these militants?
Many people last night felt like anything should be done to get him back. Many people suggested direct force to just go in and storm the city and find him. When it comes to any kind of negotiations or things like that, no one was very specific. Everyone just wanted just about everything that could be done to get him back.
Well, Aries, thank you.
Thank you.
WHYY reporter Aries Keck. In Israeli politics, there are two constants, the question of the Palestinians and political corruption scandals, and sometimes the two run in tandem. This week, Israel's attorney general dropped bribery charges against Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, and that, some would say, may be good news for peace in the Middle East. With the scandal behind him, they say, Sharon can now push ahead on his plans to withdraw Israeli forces and settlers from Gaza, with support from those who wouldn't back him under the cloud of a court trial. Well, joining us now is one of Sharon's staunchest political opponents. Yossi Beilin is head of the Ahad Party and author of the new book, Path to Geneva. And Mr. Beilin, bribery charges have been dropped. Officials say there was a lack of evidence. How specifically does that affect ongoing politics?
I think that it might pave the way for the Labour Party to join a unity government under Sharon, despite the fact that there is another case which is still open and about which the Attorney General has not decided whether to indict Mr. Sharon or not.
In fact, the Labour Party promised this week that it would abstain in any votes of no confidence that are taken in Parliament. Essentially, they promised to help their opponent, Sharon, head of the opposing Likud, stay in power. Why would they do that?
Well, the official answer would be that they would like to promote the idea of a withdrawal from Gaza. The real answer, I believe, is a mixed one. On the one hand, maybe they would like to see such a withdrawal. On the other side, they wish to be in power.
Well, you oppose Sharon's policies on the Palestinian front. He's calling for no negotiations, unilateral withdrawal from Gaza, dismantling settlements there while beefing up West Bank settlements. But many Israelis who also previously opposed Sharon now support him, if begrudgingly. And I'm wondering, can you see how they might feel? It's been quiet. There have been no suicide bombings in Israel. Some are saying this plan is better than nothing.
This is true. This is the only true thing. This plan is better than nothing. And that is why we will support the plan if it comes to the Knesset vote. But we will not give Sharon any safety net, and we will not vote confidence in Sharon, because we in the Yahad party, in the opposition, do not have confidence in Sharon in his plan. I think that we must have a permanent solution agreed by the Palestinians, and that bypassing it and taking our own decisions, unilateral decisions, will eventually be a very, very problematic boomerang, because eventually it must explode in our face.
Those who oppose the withdrawal from Gaza say that it essentially encases the Palestinians in a prison. In fact, the Bush administration has recently demanded of the Israeli government that they enact some way that the Palestinians will be able to have an economy after a withdrawal. what do you think needs to be implemented in order to make a withdrawal work?
What has to be done is to make out of the withdrawal from Gaza a leverage towards a permanent agreement. And that can be done only through negotiations with the Palestinians. What Sharon is doing is that he's negotiating with the whole world, with the Americans, with the Egyptians, with others, only in order not to talk to the Palestinians directly. And God knows what is the wisdom behind it. Sharon was the one who demanded that the Palestinians nominate their own prime minister, and they did. He did not help the first one, Abu Mazen, and he resigned. Now there is another one, Abu Allah, who is a pragmatic person and with whom it is possible to negotiate. And I think that by not negotiating with him, he's strengthening the Hamas, the ultra-religious groups on the Palestinian side. What we may do by unilaterally withdrawing from Gaza is to strengthen the terrorists in Gaza itself. And this is why what we need to do, I believe, is to say, okay, we are leaving Gaza, but we are returning in a parallel way to the negotiating table in order to get a permanent agreement.
Before we let you go, Israel has proposed building a massive 80-foot-deep trench between Egypt and Gaza. Israel saying this is to stop the smuggling of weapons through tunnels. What's been reaction to that in Israel?
I think that there are people who believe that we live in another century. To build today walls and fences and trenches and to believe that by doing that you can really defend yourself is, I believe, naivete. But the price for this naivete is, first of all, a very expensive expenditure. We don't have this money. And I believe that what we are doing is creating Israel as a kind of a new Jewish ghetto and spending so much money on it rather than to open up to our neighbors, to talk with them seriously and to have with them peace.
Mr. Bailin, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yossi Bailin is an Israeli politician, peace negotiator, and author. His new book is called The Path to Geneva. And this news update, Saudi authorities have expanded their search for kidnapped American Paul Johnson to the desert outside Riyadh. As we heard earlier, helicopters and over 1,000 Saudi police have been scouring urban areas where al-Qaeda followers live in an effort to find the American engineer before today's deadline set by Islamic militants for his execution. A former Saudi deputy interior minister made a televised plea to Saudis to help in the search, and a top cleric and friends of Mr. Johnson have made online pleas at militant websites as well. Later in the program, the 9/11 Commission says there's no link between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda. Does that mean there's no relationship? There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And it's the season of big-budget summer blockbusters. But if Steven Spielberg's Terminal or Ben Stiller in Dodgeball aren't your thing, the small, quirky comedy Napoleon Dynamite just might be. The object of a bidding war at this year's Sundance Film Festival, Napoleon Dynamite's been described as Election meets Welcome to the Dollhouse meets Revenge of the Nerds. First-time actor John Heder stars in the title role as a geeky, red-haired high school student with an affection for unicorns, moon boots, and tater tots.
Pauline, give me some of your tots.
No, go find your own.
Come on, give me some of your tots.
No, I didn't get to eat anything today. Oh, God. Gross.
A scene from the new film Napoleon Dynamite. And here now is Renee Graham is in the studio with her review. Renee, I think the title gives something away there, the title of the film, Napoleon Dynamite. Tell us about this guy.
Well, I mean, the funny thing about the title, of course, that it sounds like, you know, a character from a blaxploitation film. And what you end up with is this sort of, you know, wispy, dorky guy with hair like a rusty Brillo pad, sort of trying to make his way through high school in Preston, Idaho.
And you've told me that it is a little quirky film, but it's hard to explain in some ways, so let's try. It's set in 24-year-old filmmaker Jared Hess's hometown. Mm-hmm. Is it a high school film?
it is a high school film in that a good amount of the action takes place in high school, but I don't think people should confuse this with the sort of typical and traditional kind of teen comedy. It's not that, even though it's quite funny. You've got this character, Napoleon Dynamite. We assume he's about 17, 18 years old. He gets laughed at by the girls at his school, but he doesn't seem really unhappy. He, in some sort of strange way, he's content in this world, even though he spends a lot of his time, drawing pictures of different creatures and playing tetherball by himself.
What are you drawing?
A liger.
What's a liger?
It's pretty much my favorite animal. It's like a lion and a tiger mixed. Bred for its skills and magic.
Is this film cruel in any way, or is it tender toward? How does it treat the character?
There have been a lot of comparisons with this film and Todd Solondz's Welcome to the Dollhouse. And I think the real difference is, whereas Welcome to the Dollhouse was really cynical, this film is actually very sweet. It's not sappy, but there's a real sweetness, and you get the feeling that the filmmakers actually do like these characters. He's really this magnified version of every awkward teenager, and also the awkward teenager that still exists inside every adult, who doesn't quite fit in, but is just still sort of finding his place, and he has a small little circle of friends. He has this shy Mexican kid, Pedro, he's friends with, and also Deb, who goes to the prom with Pedro, but, may have a bit of a crush on Napoleon as well, as we'll hear in this next clip.
So you and Pedro are getting really serious now?
No. We're just friends.
Huh. How are your glamour shots been going lately?
Pretty good. I could do a personal portrait sometime, if you wanted to come over.
Okay.
A scene from the new film Napoleon Dynamite. And I understand, in addition to his friends, there's the family.
He has family. He has a motorcycle-riding grandmother who breaks her coccyx.
Oh, boy.
Racing her motorcycle in the desert one time. And then when she's laid up, their uncle, Rico, the really creepy, icky Uncle Rico, comes to live with them to take care of them. Although it's really strange to take care of them, because Napoleon also lives with his 32-year-old brother, Kip, who seems to be unemployed and is as much of a dweeb as Napoleon is, and spends all of his time on the internet and in chat rooms, and especially talking to his internet girlfriend, as we'll hear him sort of taunt Napoleon with in this next scene.
Napoleon, don't be jealous that I've been chatting online with babes all day. Besides, we both know I'm training to become a cage fighter.
Since when, Kip? You have the worst reflexes of all time.
Try and hit me, Napoleon.
What?
I said come down here and see what happens if you try and hit me.
Such an idiot.
Let me see what your best move is.
I'll go get it.
Jeez.
And of course, there, as soon as Kip looks away, Napoleon slaps him.
Okay, so we understand that the director is a Mormon. He graduated from Brigham Young University. Many in the cast also BYU grads.
That's true.
Including the star. It's rated PG. It's a teen movie without sex, drugs, or profanity. But is it one of those late night anti-drug ads? Where does it get its edge or its feel?
The edge is in this sort of strangely quirky character.
Hey, is that a new kid or something?
Napoleon, this is Pedro. Would you mind showing him where his locker is?
Sure. Come on. There's like a buttload of gangs at this school. This one gang kept wanting me to join because I'm pretty good with the bow staff. Did you ride the bus to school?
No. I ride my bike.
What kind of bike do you have?
It's a sledgehammer.
Dang. You got shocks, pegs, Lucky.
We don't hear a lot about films coming out of the Mormon community. Is there any sense of how that might have impacted this movie?
I'm not sure. I mean, it certainly isn't a Mormon film. I mean, he could have set it in Utah, and it is set in his hometown of Idaho. And I don't know if that plays into the fact that there's no sex, there's no profanity, but you don't really miss it in a strange way. And the movie is rated PG, which is fairly odd for a film that it doesn't involve CGI animation. I don't know how that really plays into it, but it doesn't really stand out. You don't realize until after the movie's over that, you know, the worst words you've heard were maybe moron and freaking.
And as you said, it's not saccharine. It's not a...
It's not saccharine. I mean, there's a certain edge to the film, but it's also sweet. You know, you laugh at these characters, certainly, but you also laugh with them in certain ways. And probably because everyone has known someone like Napoleon Dynamite. And in some cases, the people watching will realize that they were Napoleon Dynamite.
We've been thinking that the only other Mormon director we can think of is Neil LaBute.
Neil LaBute.
Who is cruel.
Who doesn't make sweet little movies like this.
That's right. Well, what do you think? Cult hit?
Absolutely. Cult hit. No question. I mean, I think this is the kind of film where, you know, people will show up at midnight showings and they will act it out and they will scream out their favorite lines. It's a funny little film. Hard to describe, but I highly recommend it.
Well, I think you did a fine job. Renee, thanks.
Thanks, Robin.
Kieran Ells, Renee Graham with her review of the new film Napoleon Dynamite. Renee's also pop culture correspondent for the Boston Globe. And next week on Here and Now, one of the most powerful men in Congress faces an ethics investigation. We'll look at the life and times of Tom DeLay. Stay with us. More ahead Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The White House is on the defensive after the 9/11 Commission reported earlier this week that they found no evidence of a collaborative relationship between Iraq and al-Qaeda. Here's Commission Chairman Thomas Kane.
What we have found is that were there contacts between al-Qaeda and Iraq? Yes. Some of them are shadowy, but there's no question they were there. So that is correct. What our staff statement found is there's no credible evidence that we can discover after a long investigation that Iraq and Saddam Hussein in any way were part of the attack on the United States.
President Bush responded a day later, telling a reporter, "The reason I keep insisting that there was a relationship between Iraq and Saddam and al-Qaeda is because there was a relationship between Iraq and al-Qaeda." And this morning, Vice President Dick Cheney appeared on NBC's Today Show.
First of all, on the question of whether or not there was any kind of a relationship. There clearly was a relationship. It's been testified to. The evidence is overwhelming. It goes back to the early 90s. It involves a whole series of contacts, high-level contacts, between Osama bin Laden and Iraqi intelligence officials.
Dick Cheney and others say it's the press that has clouded the issue. Well, we've invited two members of the Fourth Estate to clear the air. Andrea Stone, congressional correspondent for USA Today. Hi, Andrea.
Hi, Robin.
And Jonathan Alter, senior editor for Newsweek magazine. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, Robin.
Well, Jonathan, to you first. Dick Cheney says the press, specifically the New York Times, confused this issue. There was a Times headline that said, let me read it to you, "Panel finds no Qaeda-Iraq tie." Is the problem the use of the word tie as opposed to collaborative relationship?
Collaborative relationship's a little long to fit into a headline, and it takes a lot of chutzpah for the vice president to talk about the press fuzzing up this issue, since basically the premise on which they took the country to war was to fuzz the issue.
But, Jonathan, as you know, the White House is saying today that they never, ever said that Saddam Hussein or Iraq were involved in 9/11.
They overwhelmingly left that impression. They hawked this meeting between Mohammed Atta and Iraqi officials in Prague that never actually took place.
But, Andrew, jump in here. Is it fair for the press to use words like ties when the commission itself also pointed out ties, you know, in other words, meetings between al-Qaeda operatives and Iraqi operatives?
We're talking about a lot of semantics here. I think the most important point or fact is, did Saddam Hussein, or did Iraq help to plan or carry out the 9/11 attacks? And the commission has said, you know, bluntly, no. And I think Jonathan is right that they kind of left a perception there, which they never really kind of solidified, you know, to let the public think that maybe there was something shadowy, something involved. And I think today, you know, you're seeing some of the more conservative press, like the Wall Street Journal, is saying, well, as you referred to Muhammad Atta as having cell phone conversations in Florida, they're saying, well, how do we know he was using the cell phone? How do we know somebody else wasn't using his phone and he wasn't in Prague meeting with Iraqis? You know, just because Osama bin Laden made overtures to Iraq doesn't mean that Iraq reciprocated. Mm-hmm. And I think he made overtures to a lot of regimes, and Sudan among them, Afghanistan, of course. But that really is a stretch to go from that to saying that we went to war because Iraq had something to do with 9/11.
And Jonathan, do you think that what we're hearing in the last couple of days is part of a, maybe even the beginning of an effort to dismiss the final report?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, they didn't want this commission to come into existence. It was only because of the September 11th families that we even got a commission to investigate what happened. This administration preferred that there be no investigation, and then they tried to drag their feet on it and starve them of resources. So, yes, I think they would like to discredit this report. They'd rather that their version of reality prevail. You know, just to get back just for a minute to this question of what ties are, if you think of instead of thinking of al-Qaeda and these awful terrorists, think of it as a business relationship. If somebody goes and has a business meeting with somebody else and they talk about doing a deal, in this case it would be setting up terrorist training camps in Iraq, and one of the parties says, no, we don't want to be in business with you. We don't want a deal, which is what Iraq said to al-Qaeda. Subsequent to that, is it fair to say that they have ties? Mm. You know, mm. I mean, if they don't actually go into business together, what kind of ties do they have that they had a conversation?
Mm. Andrea, I'm curious from you, while we're all talking the semantics, you know, what's a relationship, what's a tie, what's collaborative, what is being overlooked by this discussion? What did the commission say that jumped out at you?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, al-Qaeda has been looking into, you know, getting anthrax. We did have an anthrax attack here in Washington. We never really solved who was behind that. You know, they did have weapons of mass destruction. They used them on the Kurds. Of course, whether they had them when we went to war last year is another question. You know, look, you know, I mean, I think that Saddam Hussein was a bad guy, and, you know, he did a lot of bad things. But again, the reason we went to war, according to the administration, was 9/11 and weapons of mass destruction, and those two reasons don't seem to have panned out. And the administration is—we saw this yesterday—was really on the defensive because one by one, the legs of why we are in Iraq now, why we've lost over 800 troops there, 5,000 wounded, is being taken out from underneath them.
And as you point out, we're learning more about al-Qaeda and how they've maybe even increased their strength.
Right. That's another point. You know, many people have pointed out that while, yes, there might have been these links, ties, whatever you want to call them, before 9/11 or before this latest Iraq war, it was only after the war and the chaos that ensued after that we had Zarqawi and other people really, you know, coming to the fore. This has now become a new Afghanistan in terms of a haven for these terrorists. So in some ways, where the administration is saying that they have made the world safer because Saddam Hussein is gone, I'm not sure.
Well, Jonathan Alter, one last question before we let you both go. Back to the semantics. Some have said, why doesn't the Bush administration just stand up and make a primetime speech with President Bush saying, polls show that something like 70% of you think that the hijackers of 9/11 were Iraqis. I need to tell you they weren't.
As if, as my kids would say. No, this is not going to happen, and this administration won't admit even the smallest error. Remember, the president was asked at press conferences, is there anything you regret about what's happened in Iraq, any mistakes that were made? This is after the occupation had made repeated, irrefutable mistakes in the way they failed to secure Baghdad. They disbanded the Iraqi army, on and on and on. and the president couldn't admit to having made any mistakes, unlike, say, President Kennedy admitting the Bay of Pigs was a fiasco. So to expect them to stand up and say that one of the principal reasons for going to war is not true is expecting too much from these folks.
Well, I want to thank you both.
My pleasure.
Thanks very much, Robin.
Jonathan Alter, senior editor for Newsweek magazine, and Andrea Stone, congressional correspondent for USA Today. And still to come, the original manuscript for The Big Book, the Bible of Alcoholics Anonymous, goes on the auction block, handwritten, notations and all. You're listening to Here and Now. A gruesome double murder was reported earlier this week in Hollywood, California. The alleged killer is a transient, a known methamphetamine user. The victims appear to have been randomly chosen. One, a retired doctor, stabbed many times. The other, 91-year-old Robert Lees, who was decapitated. Lees was a Hollywood screenwriter, one of the first people blacklisted during the McCarthy hearings of the 1950s. Headlines about his death are reminding people of his storied life. We're joined by historian Paul Buell, lecturer at Brown University and co-author of the recent book Tender Comrades. And, Paul, I understand that you interviewed Robert Lees for your book.
At length and several times, spoke with him and spent some social time with him and gained a great deal of wisdom and took in the enormous kindness of the fellow.
What did he tell you about his time before the House Un-American Activities Committee?
Well, in a certain curious way, all of his life had been leading up to it. He was a middle-class Jewish background in San Francisco. He came to Los Angeles during the Depression. He dropped out of UCLA. He went to work in the shorts department of a motion picture studio, and there were the worst-paid writers. He became a founder of the Screenwriters Guild. He wrote some of the best comedies of the 1940s, and just as he was on the verge of signing with Desi Arnaz to write the television show I Love Lucy, he was called in by HUAC and told, like others, that if he would not name the names of his friends as being communists, that he would no longer work again in films.
And what did he do?
He, of course, being a dignified person, absolutely refused and went underground, so to speak. He wrote under pseudonyms various television shows. One of them was for the first successful British show in the United States, The Adventures of Robin Hood. And he did some other work, such as write an episode of Alfred Hitchcock Presents, and a few specials, including one on the Hearst Mansion, a sort of irony since the Hearst family was very much in support of the blacklist. But basically, he could not recover the position that he lost.
Well, would it be safe to say that his best work was the Abbott and Costello work that he did?
He actually received an Academy Award nomination for one of the shorts he wrote for Robert Benchley called How to Sleep in 1935. But his most famous work was with the Abbott and Costello in the 40s, and I would say the very best were Hold That Ghost with Joan Davis as a comedian lead, The Wistful Widow of Wagon Gap, which was a satire on Westerns, really splendid, and Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, which was said to be Jerry Garcia's very favorite film.
Well, we understand that even though he was writing with a pseudonym, he never went back to film writing, and then eventually even the TV writing dried up a little. He went to Arizona where he became a maitre d' at a restaurant, came back to Los Angeles. Your thoughts on hearing of Robert Lee's death?
That's a gruesome story which has a gruesome ending. But I think it's terribly important to remember that when he faced the dime being dropped on him, he didn't have any hesitation about himself. He deeply regretted not being able to write for movies anymore, but he didn't let it get him down, so that he felt that he'd had at least a moment, a good 10 years, and that's more than most people get in Hollywood, and that he'd done what was right from beginning to end.
Paul Buell, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Paul Buell, author of Tender Comrades, remembering the life of Hollywood screenwriter Robert Lees, who was murdered earlier this week. Stay with us. There's more. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The original manuscript for The Big Book, The Bible of Alcoholics Anonymous, goes on the auction block at Sotheby's today. The 1938 manuscript, complete with notations in the margins, became sort of a spiritual how-to manual for recovery, and it's expected to fetch as much as $500,000. It was cobbled together by AA founder Bill Wilson, a man who's credited with saving millions of lives. Author and recovering alcoholic Susan Cheever was on our program recently to talk about Bill Wilson. Her latest book is called My Name is Bill, His Life and the Creation of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she began by telling us about Bill Wilson's own drinking problem.
Bill Wilson was a classic alcoholic. He, as they say, drank away all his money, his wife's money. He fell down. He was bleeding. He would go out to play golf and come back 3 days later or be found somewhere. But let me also say, alcoholism is bad. It's responsible for almost half of all automobile fatalities. It's responsible for 25% of emergency room admissions. I mean, it is bad, 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 bad. So when you say how bad was Bill Wilson, well, he was as bad as alcoholics get.
While also being a shining star, he built fortunes. He was beautiful. People loved him. He was brilliant. I mean, this roller coaster of, incredible success and terrible self-inflicted failure, he turned down a job with his hero, Thomas Edison.
And I think that was a breaking point for Bill Wilson when Thomas Edison offered him a tailor-made job for him. And he just decided he didn't want it. And he had a terrible life. But at the point that he turned down the Edison job, he was turning on himself and helping to create a terrible life.
And then the realization that astonished him that even when he wanted to stop, he couldn't.
He came to understand that it wasn't a matter of willpower, that it wasn't a matter of discipline, that it wasn't a matter of people telling you to stop, that an alcoholic is required to have or needs to have some kind of change of heart. And all the yelling and preaching in the world is not going to make any difference.
Yeah, which is a hard thing for people to hear who are the ones doing the yelling and preaching. And enter Lois, who is his longtime wife, 53 years, and she formed the support group Al-Anon for the family members
yes.
of alcoholics. How did it work? Another point you write about, he asks another drunk to help him, unheard of.
Well, that's one of the pieces. When he, Bill Wilson, has actually succeeded in stopping drinking, he'll never have another drink. He doesn't know that. And he hasn't had a drink for 4 months, and he's in Akron, Ohio, and he wants to drink very, very badly. And he reaches out and finds another drunk, another man who's in terrible trouble, Dr. Robert Smith, and finally, cajoles this guy into talking to him because he, Bill Wilson, feels that talking to Robert Smith will help him. And that's what, of course, convinced Dr. Robert Smith to try to get sober himself. Bill Wilson was very clear when he talked to Dr. Robert Smith that he was there to help himself, not that he was going to tell Dr. Robert Smith to stop drinking or that he was going to tell him what to do in any way.
Mm. You've written famously about your own drinking, about at the age of six being taught how to make a martini by your grandmother, about your father, John Cheever, taking you to AA meetings when you were young. And here you are writing about this incredibly important man in what is really an anonymous movement. How do you handle that?
I'm not in the book. It's not connected to me at all. In fact, I'm fond of saying I have very little to do with this book. It's an amazing story, and I just happen to have the good luck to be able to tell it. My first exposure to Bill Wilson was when my father got sober in 1975, and my father went from being a bad drunk to being the most wonderful father on earth, to being compassionate and funny and loving. And that certainly got my attention. We don't have many ways to deal with addiction, and Alcoholics Anonymous is the way that works the best. Mm. And I think that's miraculous.
I'm thinking Bill Wilson turned down big, high-paying jobs, made the decision not to make himself the center of the movement. If he'd made different decisions along the way, it might not have worked.
Oh, there were many, many times when it looked as if it wasn't going to work. You know, Bill at one point famously turned to his wife and he said, this isn't working. I mean, we've had 30 men who got sober and 29 of them have gone back out and started drinking again. This doesn't work. And his wife said, well, we've had one person stay sober. And Bill Wilson said, well, who's that? And she said, well, it's you. Mm-hmm. As for the anonymity subject, Bill Wilson understood very well that in order to get sober, an alcoholic has to focus entirely on getting sober, and that who that alcoholic might be besides being an alcoholic is not relevant. And that's why he turned down a degree from Yale University, although he very much wanted it. That's why he refused to be on the cover of Time, is that he wanted to give this message that if you want to get sober, if you're homeless or if you're a CEO, those things are completely irrelevant.
Can you possibly put in words how people feel toward this man who's, you know, who really they only know as Bill?
When people's lives get saved, they're incredibly grateful. I mean, it isn't just the alcoholic getting better. As I experienced with my father, the whole family gets better. If you have an alcoholic in your family, you may be as crazy as they are. So that when an alcoholic gets sober, it has a huge effect.
I have a friend who has been waging a small campaign. He says he should get some kind of, you know, the Nobel something.
Well, he didn't want the Nobel. They actually approached him. I agree he should get the Nobel Prize. But you know what? He's gotten something much better, which is he's helped millions and millions of people and what he wanted, which was to be able to stop drinking himself. And if you go to the graveyard in East Dorset where Bill Wilson is buried, you see that that gravestone is often covered with just little tokens of gratitude that people bring from all over the world, you know, a flower, a coin, a note, to say thank you to him. And I think that that was more valuable to him than the Nobel Prize.
Susan Cheever, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Author Susan Cheever. Her book is called My Name is Bill, His Life and the Creation of Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, Sunday is Father's Day, and I'm reminded that one of my most cherished possessions is the copy of the big book my dad left after he died. The big book, written by Bill Wilson with the help of others, is the Bible of AA. It's been published in 43 different languages and has sold more than 22 million copies. And in his usual selfless way, Bill Wilson's name is not on it. But his handwriting is all over the original manuscript for the book, which goes on the auction block today at Sotheby's in New York. Selby Kiefer is Senior Vice President of Books at Sotheby's. He joins us on the line. Selby, what does this manuscript look like?
Well, it looks like a very frenzied term paper, if you will, except that it's much longer. It's 161 pages that are typewritten, but then virtually every page is covered with pencil and ink, corrections, changes, rewritings, in a multitude of hands. It was really a collaborative effort, and you can see the development of the final text as all of these emendations and changes are made.
Yeah, but Bill Wilson called on a lot of people to help him write the big book. What does this manuscript tell us about the foundation of Alcoholics Anonymous?
Well, I think it really demonstrates that it was important to get a consensus of opinion for the program. There were then, as there are now, different points of view of how to deal with addiction. And rather than simply state what had worked for him, Bill W. and some of his other collaborators, I think, felt it was important to get feedback from a wide audience so that their program would be acceptable to the widest number of alcoholics.
Mm. How did Sotheby's happen to come into possession of the manuscript?
Well, the current owner, who received it by descent, it was a gift from Bill W.'s wife and eventually came to the aunt of our consigner, brought it to us. He is a member of the program, as was his aunt, and I think he sensed that this was historically and socially important and perhaps commercially valuable as well.
He has been quoted as saying that it's not, he's not in it for the money, but there could be a lot of money in it.
In fact, our pre-sale estimate is $300,000 to $500,000, which I think is appropriate given the enormous impact that this manuscript has had on millions of people around the world. And certainly we've had any number of potential bidders make inquiries. It will be exciting to see later this afternoon what the final price is.
Well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Selby Kiefer of Sotheby's, New York, which today will auction off the original manuscript for The Big Book, The Bible of AA. Whatever it brings in, it won't match the value of my dad's dog-eared copy, which is priceless. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a good weekend and join us again. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.